Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
The Fed kicking off its two-day policy meeting tomorrow, and Bloomberg Economics has this really cool tool. It's called the Fed Sentiment Index. It's powered by natural language processing. It's an algorithm based on more than 60,000 Fed headlines, and it shows that back in December, Powell delivered a major pivot. Okay, we knew that from just watching the markets and seeing how investors have reacting. There's a catch, though. 4 months on, with demand powering ahead and inflation stuck above target, Powell has been forced into a reversal. The index now shows that there's more work to do to bring inflation back under control. Tom Orlick is Bloomberg Economics' chief economist. He edited the story that's today's big take, also among the most read on the Bloomberg Terminal. He joins us from our Washington, D.C. bureau. So, Tom, explain what exactly the FedSpeak tool is. Tell us how it works, and also how it can give us some sort of preview of what we may hear from Jay Powell come Wednesday at the press conference.
Well, great to be here, Tim. So what we've done is we've taken 60,000 Bloomberg News headlines on FedSpeak, the things which Powell and his team on the FOMC say to steer the markets on where policy is going. And we've trained a natural language processing algorithm to read those headlines as hawkish, neutral, or dovish. What that means is that anytime we get a new Fed headline, our algorithm can read it, assign a score to it, and we can tell you whether the Fed is trending towards cuts, towards hikes, or towards a hold at its next meeting. Now, the index is right now is telling us something pretty interesting. It's showing that in December, there was a major dovish pivot. That was well-timed. We think it saved the US economy from a looming downturn. But in economics, as in life, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Mm-hmm. And the same impulse which propped up growth is now also giving an additional impulse to inflation. Our index shows that's already prompted a mini reverse pivot by Powell. He's already moved back in a hawkish direction. We think that pivot has further to travel, perhaps as soon as this week's FOMC.
So, Tom, what did the natural language tool teach us in December that we wouldn't have been able to figure out without using the tool?
So that's a really great question, Emily. Let's go back to a lady called Ellen Mead. Ellen Mead was a senior economist at the Fed, left a few years ago to become a professor at Duke University. And she was one of the pioneers of using data science, machine learning, natural language processing to understand Fed communications. And what her early research demonstrated is that these data science tools, they can reveal insights which aren't kind of visible when we're just reading the headlines ourselves. And when it comes to December, what our index is telling us is that really this was a very significant pivot, one of the biggest monetary policy surprises of the current cycle. What our index is currently telling us, based on the latest readings from April, is that things have started moving back in a more hawkish direction, but really they've undone only a small amount of the stimulus that they unleashed with that December pivot. And that's why our US team, our chief US economist, Anna Wong and her colleagues, think that Powell has further to go in a hawkish direction.
Hey, Tom, one interesting part of the story that is included in today's big take is this idea that, well, with rates high, why are we still seeing inflation high? And different theories are put forth. And there's this theory that's gotten a little bit of attention over the last month when it comes to MMT and the idea that actually hikes from the Fed are a growth driver rather than a drag on the economy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's an intriguing idea, Tim. Basically, it goes something like this. Households, businesses have got so much money in savings accounts and in bonds where they're getting higher returns when interest rates go up that that's giving a boost to spending power. And so perhaps Fed hikes aren't a drag on demand and a drag on inflation. Perhaps in the current cycle, they're actually a driver, boosting spending power and actually keeping inflation lodged at a high level. So that's an intriguing idea. It's an idea which has caught the attention of the markets, including from some big investors moving a huge amount of money around. Our view is that it's a bit difficult to support with either the economic theory or the economic data. If you think about it from the theory perspective, well, actually, it's not too far from the view set out by Turkey's president Erdogan, who, of course, famously said rate hikes drive inflation, rate cuts reduce inflation. And look what happened to Turkey, right? Turkey had spiraling inflation, a collapsing currency. So it doesn't seem like the theory worked out very well there. And then if we look at the data, well, it does seem to us that interest income has actually been a drag on consumption this year, not a driver. So an intriguing theory, one that's fired the attention of the markets, not one which we give a huge amount of credibility to.
So what should we be looking out for on Wednesday? Is this going to be a Powell that has to kind of walk back some of that dovishness that he did present during this, you know, big December pivot that your tool is showing?
So it's interesting, Emily. I mean, certainly we're not going to hear the same kind of dovish messages from Powell that we heard in December. Already in April, we heard from Powell that the data wasn't giving him confidence in disinflation, that the Fed was prepared to wait with policy settings restrictive for as long as it takes to be convinced that disinflation is on track and price gains are coming back to their 2% target. The question at Wednesday's press conference is if he goes further than that. And perhaps hints at a world where there are no rate cuts coming in 2024, or maybe in a risk scenario, also raises the possibility, not as a base case for the Fed, but as a possibility that there could be cuts, hikes coming if needed.
Our thanks to Tom Orlick, Bloomberg Economics Chief Economist. Check out today's big take. It's just a fantastic read. The natural language processing tool, the FedSpeak tool. Very cool stuff. And at Big Take or Bloomberg.com/Big Take.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Okay, something really interesting is happening in the world of electricity generation here in the U.S. and the way that people are thinking about nuclear power right now. So more than a dozen U.S. nuclear reactors that have been shut down in recent years, maybe they were too costly to operate, they were struggling to compete against renewable power, and also they were struggling to compete against plants that burn cheap natural gas. Conventional wisdom long held that these closures were permanent. Now the industry is rethinking that view. Will Wade is Bloomberg News power and renewable energy reporter. He joins us here in the Bloomberg studio. So, Will, as you mentioned, this is a, as you write in the piece, which I just read from, this is a story about economics. It's a story about numbers here.
Yeah.
These are power plants that were once thought to be too expensive to operate. But something happened over the last few years that changed the equation. What was it?
Well, so nuclear power plants are big, expensive to operate. They need a lot of security. It's a complicated thing to build. I've been covering nuclear for about 5 years, and when I started, the only real story was, which plant are we going to close down next? And I started keeping a spreadsheet a few years ago, and I tracked 13 reactors that shut down since 2013, and they were all shut down ahead of time, before they were supposed to run out of operating time. And every time it was like, we just can't compete. Gas is cheap, solar is cheap, wind is cheap, nuclear is expensive. So they all shut down, and I asked everyone, I was like, well, is that permanent? They're like, oh yeah, we're never turning those things back on again. But in the past maybe 2 years or so, there's been a reversal, and it's really about climate change. Nuclear is carbon-free energy. And people are starting to say, we really need those nuclear power plants.
So it's not as much about how expensive natural gas became in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine globally.
No, that was an anomaly. It went up, it's come down. It's pretty cheap right now.
So it's less about economics and more about
clean
environmentalists.
Energy. Yeah, it's about clean energy.
But what's interesting about that is environmentalists hated nuclear power plants for so many years.
And some still do. I mean, there's still reasonably strong opposition to nuclear power plants. And it's true, the nuclear waste is really bad stuff. And it's not going away. It's still there. But what I like to say is that the prospect, the potential threat of a nuclear disaster is now being, compared to the definite threat of climate change.
So who is actually behind these changes? This is environmentalists persuading politicians now to reopen this? This is just the science community?
Oh, it's coming from all sorts of directions. One of my favorite stories from last year, was about like Miss America, who is a huge pro-nuclear activist. Well, not the one we have now. She had to relinquish the crown, but last year's Miss America. And all of these young kids, all these 20-somethings, there's a huge wave of young people saying, we need nuclear energy. There's a groundswell of support for it. It's been coming from everywhere.
Yeah, it's pretty wild to see. I mean, so let's talk about certain plants. In your piece, you mentioned a dozen plants over the last few years that have been shut down. You weren't able to figure out the names of the ones that could be reopened necessarily, all of them.
Okay, here's the name you want to know. It's Palisades.
Okay.
So of all the plants that I tracked that were shutting down, Palisades was the last one that shut down in 2022. And almost immediately, it's in Michigan, people were starting to think, maybe that was a mistake. Like even before it shut down, like a couple weeks before it shut down, the governor was sending around a letter to the energy department saying, can we not shut it down? Can we figure out a way to keep it open? It did shut down, but almost immediately the company that bought it, its name is Haltech, started saying, we could keep it open. We can figure out a way to turn this around. They just got a couple of weeks ago a $1.5 billion loan from the Department of Energy to restart it. And there was another one in California, Diablo Canyon, that was going to shut down.
My hometown nuclear power plant.
That's right, Tim, I know.
Yeah.
So that was slated to be next, but the California state government started saying, we actually should keep it open for the clean energy.
What about 3 Mile Island? You mentioned that one in the piece as well.
Okay, so there's 2 3 Mile Island reactors. Mm-hmm. One of them everybody knows. They had the accident in 1979. It's been shut ever since. The other one shut down in 2019. It ran for decades without incident. Mm-hmm. That's one of the plants that I've heard mentioned by name as maybe it could reopen. I talked to the company. They're not saying there's no plans. They're not talking about doing it. So something to keep in mind is that the shift here, we don't have definite plans that I'm hearing about. We're definitely going to open this plant or that plant. But what I'm hearing is these things that everybody thought was like dead, 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 never coming back. People are starting to think maybe we can bring them back. Now, some of them, they're already being dismantled. The companies are tearing them apart. Those aren't coming back.
Like our neighbor.
Like Indian Point. North of New York City.
What's going on there?
They're tearing it apart.
Done.
Yeah,
no
way
it's
there's a
back.
Big hole in the containment zone. You don't want holes in your containment domes.
No, then it's no longer contained.
Right. So that, it would cost too much to try and fix that. There's no point. But there's others that have just been sort of mothballed and they're sitting there. Those could potentially be turned back on. It would take some work. It would cost some money, but it's doable.
What about forget turning on the old nuclear power plants that have been decommissioned. What about constructing new ones, which we've had one in recent years open here in the U.S.
Oh, two. You didn't see the news today.
Okay, today there's a new one.
Yes, Vogtle 4 went online this morning.
Okay.
So this is in Georgia. It's the only major nuclear project in America in recent decades. They were like, I don't know, 10 years late and $15 billion over budget. They were building two reactors. One of them got switched on last year. The other one officially was announced this morning. So that's good news. But it's, you know, it's clear it's a big project. It costs a lot. The potential for going over budget is notable.
Does it show that there is an appetite? Now that environmentalists have shifted their view, does it show that there's an appetite for these expensive projects if they are indeed green, save for the nuclear waste?
Okay, well, here's another shift I've been tracking, because I watched the Vogtle project for years as it took longer and longer and longer, and the cost overruns got higher and higher and higher. The only thing I ever heard is, we're never doing that again. And maybe in the last year or so, I've started to hear, maybe we could do that again. So, like, again, nobody's announcing plans to do it. Mm-hmm. But just the idea that people are starting to say, maybe we could, that tells me there's a big shift.
Can we zoom out a little bit? What does this all mean then for the future of renewable power? I guess with these reopenings, like, how close are we getting to actually having a significant portion of the U.S.'s energy supply rely on nuclear?
It's going to happen, but it's a slow thing. Nuclear is a really slow industry to cover. The next thing you want to be watching for are small modular reactors. It's a different generation of nuclear technology.
And there are a bunch of startups working on this.
There's a couple dozen that I know of that are working on it. Probably not this decade, maybe one or two small ones this decade, but the 2030s, we could see a decent amount of it.
Okay, let's get to the waste issue here. Because, as you mentioned, nuclear waste is not going away. Where does it end up going? And with this shifting view, is it viewed differently at all?
Oh, well, the answer of where it goes right now is really simple. It goes nowhere. Every single reactor has a stash of waste in these giant steel and concrete casks out behind. There's no place to put it. There was initially a push to create a national repository that kind of fell by the wayside.
This is Yucca Mountain.
It would have been Yucca Mountain. That was officially shot down after decades of talking about it. I remember people talking about it when I was in college. So for the moment, they all stay right there out behind the reactor. I was at a big nuclear power plant a couple weeks ago. They had a big stash way out back. There's some proposals to build sort of another consolidated site. It wouldn't be like Yucca Mountain, but there were two of them. One's in New Mexico, one's in West Texas. They're actually really close to each other. Both state governments have kind of passed some legislation to make those projects unviable for the moment. So for the moment, none of it's going anywhere.
Yeah, if you're a state, you don't necessarily want nuclear waste coming to your backyard, I guess it's fair to say.
The thing about nuclear waste is, I mean, there's no denying it's dangerous, but everything is dangerous. You live near a coal plant, you might get asthma. You live near a gas plant, you're going to be exposed to gas. The people who run nuclear power plants, I've always been impressed with them. They handle the stuff very carefully. We don't have a lot of accidents from leaking nuclear waste casks.
Will, very briefly, that the way you sum that up, to me, sums up what environmentalists have said in recent years. The idea of using nuclear power, the benefits outweigh the potential consequences, especially compared to burning fossil fuels.
I think everything has a risk. Everything has a cost. You just have to figure out what risks you want to take.
Will Wade, Bloomberg News Power and Renewable Energy Editor, here in our Bloomberg studio. Check out his story and all his nuclear power coverage at the Bloomberg Terminal and, of course, at Bloomberg.com as well.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Emily, I don't know about you, but it really seems like Las Vegas is having a moment right now. What do you think?
It is.
Yeah?
I see the sphere on my Twitter all the time. Different concerts and people...
Do you see it on your Instagram, though? Just on your Twitter? Just or on your Instagram,
too?
My
Twitter.
Okay, Twitter. Interesting. Okay, so the sphere is part of it. I think the Super Bowl was a lot. There are a bunch of pro sports teams, some new, some having moved, now calling the city home. Certainly seems like Las Vegas is shining. Also, got to think about gambling. It's also doing well in Vegas. According to the industry group, the American Gaming Association, last year the Las Vegas Strip experienced the highest year-over-year gain in casino revenue growth out of any market in the U.S., For an on-the-ground update, let's go to Patrick Nichols, president and CEO of the Venetian Resort. The PE firm Apollo Global Management bought the Venetian back in 2022. The resort now undergoing a $1.5 billion renovation. Patrick, welcome to Bloomberg Business Week. Give us a business update. How is business?
Well, thanks for having me, Tim and Emily. Business is great. You know, we've seen, as you mentioned, a record 2023 across the board at the Venetian, and the industry benefited as well. I think what's interesting about Vegas in the past few years is it's transitioned from really a gambling destination to something that's much more than that. And now with sports teams, as you mentioned, the Raiders, the Knights, the Aces, and the Sphere, it's become a very, very durable travel destination for our guests.
What about the impact of online gaming? Because now with online gaming, people don't necessarily have to go to Vegas to actually make their bets. I know that you guys do have a new sports playbook partnership with Yahoo Sports.
Yeah, we launched the Yahoo Sportsbook powered by William Hill just in time for this football season last year in 2023. It's been doing remarkably well. Just one of many new additions to the Venetian over the past few years. To answer your question about online gaming, I think what makes Vegas so special is that you can't get the Vegas experience online. So people come to Las Vegas and to the Venetian for so much more than just to put a couple dollars in a slot machine. It's about seeing fish at the Sphere or seeing U2 or coming to the Super Bowl, eating at one of the best restaurants in the world and staying in fantastic suites. So, you know, Vegas is a destination, and the Venetian within Las Vegas really creates its own experience versus what you get online.
I'm chuckling when you mentioned fish because I have a friend who traveled to Vegas just to see the fish show. I mean, lots of friends actually who did this at the Sphere, and they were like, it's indescribable, completely life-changing. It's just sounded like it was pretty cool. Speaking of the Sphere, how big of a boon is it to your business? Explain the partnership that the Venetian has with the Sphere and talk a little bit about what it means to your business.
I mean, the Sphere's been very impactful. The Venetian has four theaters today. So we have, the resort was built 25 years ago. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary in a couple of days. And 25 years ago, theaters were a lot smaller than they are today. So our largest theater that we have in the resort is about 2,200 seats, which has allowed us to do a lot of really fun programming, a lot of great bands, and a lot of great entertainment concepts. But where the Venetian has historically kind of lacked a competitive advantage is the scale, really large entertainment offering. So the Sphere with, you know, almost 20,000 seats now sets us apart. We have these intimate, great four intimate venues, and now we have the largest entertainment venue in Las Vegas physically connected to the resort. It's the easiest place to stay if you want to see a show at the Sphere. You should be staying at the Venetian. And it's been great. You know, we've seen really strong results from U2 as well as Fish. I also had a lot of friends that I didn't know were Fish fans that showed up to the show. And it's been great for business. I think it's been great for the city. And we're excited to see some future residencies at the Sphere now soon.
So you're doing a $1.5 billion renovation. What is that going to look like? What can resort guests expect out of the new changes?
Yeah, it's a big undertaking. You know, we're, as I mentioned, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary later this week on Friday. And there's no better birthday gift than $1.5 billion. So we're investing, you know, $1.5 billion into the resort. It starts first and foremost with our suites. So we're an all-suite hotel, 7,100 rooms, excuse me. We're the largest hotel in North America, and all of our suites are getting a complete redesign. So we're embracing kind of a modern Italian theme, like something you might find in, you know, modern-day Venice or Milan. And we'll start the renovation in the next few months with new renovated suites coming online in September of this year. We're also known as one of the largest convention hotels in the world. So if you have a big group convention, an expo, you're likely staying at the Venetian. We have about 2.2 million square feet of convention and expo space, and we're investing just under $200 million to create a new cutting edge meeting experience for our guests. And then of course, you know, F&B, entertainment, restaurants have become such a big part of the Las Vegas experience. So we're investing there. You'll see some new announcements coming soon on some new culinary offerings at the resort. And we're leveling up our gaming spaces as well with some new high limit spaces, a redesigned casino floor at the Venetian, new poker room that opens later this summer. And just really excited. It's not just a cosmetic upgrade or cosmetic refresh right. You might see elsewhere. Really kind of a grounds up refresh of the resort.
Hey, Patrick, I got to ask about the exit plan for the Venetian. As I mentioned, it was purchased by the private equity firm Apollo back in 2022. You were instrumental also in Blackstone's deal to sell the Cosmopolitan to MGM the previous year, back in 2021. I mean, it's private equity. I assume they want to return. What's the exit plan here?
You know, my job as CEO of the Venetian is to generate as much cash flow and earnings and potential for this resort and take care of our team here on the ground. And I leave the exit plan to Apollo. You know, that's what they do. They're the most sophisticated investors in the world. And we'll let them take care of that side while we focus on delivering the best experience we can to our guests and our team members and delivering fantastic.
Do you see this as like a long-term position that you have where you do the renovation and then you create a sustainable business moving forward? Or do you see it as one where there's an exit and then you move on to your next thing?
I think for me personally, I love the Venetian. You know, I never had the dream when I was a kid to be running a casino, but now that I'm here, there's no more enjoyable business, no more complicated business, no more surprising business day to day than the casino industry. So it's a ton of fun. It's a blast being here every day and getting to work with the best people in the industry every day is just kind of a dream come true. So I love it here. You know, I treat every job as kind of it's probably the last one I'm ever going to have. So I'm really excited to be here and we'll see what the future holds.
Patrick, we don't have a ton of time left, but who would you say is your biggest competition in Vegas right now? Who are you losing business to?
You know, thankfully we're not losing business. We're actually growing our share. I think we're one of the few casinos in the city at the moment that is stealing share from our competitors. And I think that goes back to the investment we've made to Apollo's, you know, positioning of the resort. They're incredibly, you know, competitive and also resourceful. Mm-hmm. I think we have resources and speed that our competitors don't have, and that's a huge advantage for us. So we're right now stealing share. I think if we had to look at competitors, you know, there's the old saying, you know, you don't necessarily want to follow your competition because you'll end up there. So we are trying to set our own path and move forward at a clip that our competitors can't keep up with and bring innovation to the market as fast as possible.
Patrick Nichols, president and CEO of the Venetian Resort, joining us from Las Vegas. As we mentioned, Apollo Global Management bought the Venetian back in 2022. The resort now undergoing a $1.5 billion renovation. Patrick, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. Really do appreciate it.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern.
Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, every manifestation of the dangerous weather wreaking havoc around the world has one thing in common: water. As Earth's climate changes, the lack of water or its sudden abundance is reshaping the global economy and international trade. Think about it. From prolonged drought, slowing down ships in the Panama Canal, to deluges, halting industrial production in Japan, it's one of the most obvious ways that rising temperatures are affecting business. For more on what's going on and what companies are doing to try to alleviate it, we're joined by Susan Kennedy, the CEO of the Water Management and Agricultural Resources Company, Cadiz. She joins us from Los Angeles. Susan, people who are regular listeners of the program, they know I grew up in California. I wasn't allowed to play with water guns when I was a kid because we were living through a historic drought. But the idea of a water management firm, I think, would be foreign to a lot of people who are not from an area that has experienced major drought. So explain for people what exactly Cadiz does.
Well, very nice to be here with you. Thanks for the invite. You know, I've been in California for, 50 years myself, and water is just something you don't think about. You turn on the faucet and there it is. But in fact, it's, the lifeblood of everything we do. Cadiz is one of the largest landowners in Southern California. We own 45,000 acres with water rights out in California's high desert. Cadiz Ranch has been farming out there for almost 40 years. We sit on top of this aquifer system that has more water in it than Lake Mead, the largest reservoir in the United States. And we've been developing these water assets for the last two decades. We've got water supply because we catch the water as it before it evaporates in the desert. We have water storage capacity. We have hundreds of miles of pipeline assets that we recently acquired. And we have a water treatment technology. So we're developing one of the largest new groundwater banks in the southwestern United States. And that's going to be absolutely critical for California in particular, but for the entire Southwest in the coming years.
What is the biggest problem when it comes to water and water transportation that Cadiz is trying to solve?
Well, the biggest problem is water storage. We don't have a water scarcity problem. We have the same amount of water on the planet as we've had for 4 billion years. Water doesn't leave the planet. What we have is a problem with water infrastructure, because you have to store fresh water in order to make it usable for human consumption, right? And our entire infrastructure system was developed around the snowpack. So that's where we store most of our water, is in the mountains as snow for many months out of the year. And then when it melts, it goes down into reservoirs that we've created right at the bottom of the rivers where we catch that water and store it for the rest of the summer. But the problem is that where the climate has completely changed our ability to store water is snow. We're losing our snowpack. And that's happening in California. It's happening in the Rocky Mountains. So the major sources of water for the southwestern United States, which is a huge hotspot around the world when it comes to water access, is that we're not able to store our water anymore. It's coming down in sheets as atmospheric rivers, and it's washing out to the ocean. So the biggest problem is storing water. And that's where Cadiz's land has the ability to store. We have 30, 40, 50 million acre feet of water already in storage.
And do you have room? Do you have room for more?
Yeah, but with technology to control the evaporation, we can actually import water and store it through pipelines that we have connected to our property. So we can actually store a million acre feet of water in our aquifer and hold it and there for years that we need it for drought.
Is that infrastructure already in place? I mean, when I was in middle school, the California State Water Project went through essentially my backyard. And this was like a huge, huge undertaking. And back then they were, I don't know if these numbers were correct at the time, but everyone was quoting, this was a long time ago, $1 million a mile. I mean, this was expensive back then. Like, it's not like the subway here in New York, which is much more expensive than that.
$5 million a mile now.
How much is it now?
$5 million a mile.
Yeah, so that kind of makes sense. That kind of tracks here. Is that infrastructure, though, already in place, or does it need to be built?
Well, here's where it gets interesting. So, the biggest problem with with water storage, building water storage, is you have to have the pipelines to move it hundreds of miles. And, you know, it's very, very challenging to build anything that, you know, hundreds of miles, especially in California. But we, Cadiz is actually an old railroad stop between where it was built. It was around the railroads when they had steam engines. And so they used to stop at this little town called Cadiz and get water for their steam engines. So we're sitting on a bunch of railroad lines and a bunch of gas lines. And so we purchased idle gas pipelines that were built 35 years ago that aren't in use today. And they cross hundreds of miles. So we can actually, we'll be the first in the world to convert gas pipelines to actually carry water and be able to transport water to all the major infrastructure in Southern California.
Yeah, so I'm wondering... Yeah, Susan, I'm curious. You know, it's a publicly traded company. Cadiz has a market cap of about $150 million. It's a micro cap. Shares are down 20% this year. What are investors, in your opinion, missing here?
Well, you know, we're in the utility space. Water is in the utility space, right? And so this project has been around for 20 years, and we've been developing these assets, you know, the pipeline assets and everything in the most recent years. But investors don't really look at water as a place to invest as the water industry, because it's usually done by public companies. And so, but everything changed in the last 3 years. And now I think you're seeing some really creative public-private partnerships with technology companies and with companies like ours to help build the assets and make them available for communities. So I think right now we're sort of we're invisible to the market for the most part. People aren't paying attention to us in the utility space. But I think you know, when you look at what's happening and the contracts that we've just recently entered into, you can see that this is going to be a massive project, and I think should be very attractive to investors.
Susan, what kind of regulatory hurdles are you facing right now?
You know, 20 years ago, this project was going to be purchased by the largest water agencies in Southern California to build a new storage bank. No one needed water 20 years ago, and nobody needed storage because they had Lake Mead. And so the project, any major infrastructure project, faces enormous environmental hurdles because nobody wants to build projects like this. And so, you know, it hit all the barriers, and we went through decades of litigation over the permits, and, you know, came out of all of that with everything intact and ready to go. But we've sort of have the 20 years of regulatory hell behind us, if you will.
Yeah.
And so we're now in a place where we can actually start putting the pumping stations and infrastructure in place and start moving forward.
Susan, you've been in California for years, pretty much your whole career there, and you were in the public sector for a long period of time. You were chief of staff to Governor Schwarzenegger. You were cabinet secretary to Governor Gray Davis. I had a professor in college, this was not in California, who essentially told me that people aren't supposed to live in California. It doesn't have the water infrastructure and doesn't have the water availability. It doesn't have the environment for humans to be living there. What would you say to him?
I'd say that civilizations around the entire world, developed around water resources, around rivers. And then the some of the aqueducts that we use today were designed by the Romans and the ancient Egyptians. I mean, humans have been moving water and storing water to create, you know, civilization for thousands of years. So it's not about where we're supposed to live or not live. It's about whether or not we can, you know, sustainably develop the water resources in order to feed our communities and maintain the environment.
Susan Kennedy, she is CEO of the water management and agricultural resources company Cadiz, the publicly traded firm, got a market cap of about $150 million, joining us from Los Angeles. Susan, thanks so much for taking the time. Really, really appreciate it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs.
The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Can't believe it's that time already. Bill Maloney talking a little bit about Domino's Pizza just now. I must confess, it makes me a little hungry.
They have earnings soon, right?
They had it today. Yeah, and look at this. Shares are up 5% right now. They were up as much as more than 8%. They hit the highest intraday since January of 2022. This after the company reported stronger than expected domestic comp results. Same-store sales up 5.6% for the period that ended March 24th. This was ahead of analyst estimates for a 3.9% game. Here's what the CEO said, quote, "The U.S. results came through positive order counts in both our carryout and delivery businesses for a second quarter in the row." Russell Wiener, the CEO, said that orders were generated from customers across all income cohorts.
I like Domino's. And, you know, in Manhattan, there's a lot of good pizza.
I was going to say, I mean, there are also a lot of Domino's.
It has its own lane. If you want a classic New York slice, you don't go to Domino's. But I have to admit, sometimes I'm in the mood for that Domino's thickness.
Yeah. I love it. All right, let's get a drive to the close because, believe it or not, we are just about 14 minutes away. We're about 17 minutes away from the close here. We got Tony Roth with us, Chief Investment Officer over at Wilmington Trust, joining us from Pennsylvania. Tony, good to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty well. So Emily and I are just kind of on pins and needles waiting for the Fed on Wednesday, jobs on Friday, and then before that, Apple Thursday and Amazon tomorrow. What's kind of on your radar for the week?
Probably more than anything else, focused on whether the Fed meets expectations around starting to taper the quantitative tightening of its balance sheet. So it's been, some time it's been cutting $95 billion a month, et cetera. And we'd like to be able to see the Fed stop that because it's not helping the banking ecosystem. So that would be essentially an accommodative approach for the Fed to start to no longer run down its balance sheet in that way. And the Fed has alluded to it, and we think it may actually put a plan in place this week, and it would be helpful for the banking ecosystem if it were to do that, and thereby the economy.
So Tim, I actually had the opportunity to meet Tony
over
a year ago at the Wilmington Trust 2023 Outlook event. I'm not sure if Tony remembers. I know he meets reporters all the time. But I remember that the theme of that event was that Wilmington Trust was making this big call that inflation was going to be sticky around 3% due to structural forces underlying the economy, the labor force, demographics. So
good memory.
I want to check in with you. Yeah, there was really good food there too. Taco bar or something, which I totally wasn't swayed by. But yeah, maybe update us on your inflation call and what are you thinking about now about sticky inflation, 3%, 2%, and the Fed?
Yeah, so the inflation data is really hard to understand, especially in the beginning of the year, because there are so many seasonal adjustments that come into it. And the focus has been on, of course, as it typically should be, CPI, only because CPI and PCE are so tightly correlated with one another, and CPI comes out earlier in the month. But CPI has been very dominated by the housing market and the fact that the shelter numbers take a long time to show up in the data, as well as insurance, which is a non-cyclical price adjustment, if you will, due to a lot of factors that have to do with the pandemic, which probably won't be repeated and which are not really susceptible to the influence from monetary policy from the Fed. So when you put all that together, it suggests that the look that we're getting on inflation so far this year is not necessarily a good look on inflation. And what we see is when we look at the core PCE going back 12 months, we see that we're about 2.7-2.8% going back 12 months. Now, when you look at the 3-month annualized numbers, admittedly, it's higher. It's around 3.4, which is why we think that inflation is sort of sticky, but we're not seeing it as stopping its downward march. It's just a slow march downward. We're seeing, in fact, about 15 to 20 basis points per month of reduction in housing cost acceleration in the CPI. And ultimately, we think the Fed is going to start to cut rates in July and cut the equivalent of 3 to 4 times this year. And what's really driving that more than anything else is our view on the consumer. And we do believe that the consumer is moderating. Probably we're seeing that most clearly in clients that own either restaurant chains or in retail shops, or on the part of sponsors that own portfolio companies that are also seeing significant slowdown on the part of inventory buildup and demand from both B2C and B2B. So we're definitely seeing a slowing in the economy, which is going to flow through, we believe, to the inflation data. Mm-hmm. But just not, it's not going to push us all the way to 2%, to your point of our forecast from last year, because there are some structural factors like energy, the transition to green energy, right, labor markets, et cetera, tight labor markets are going to keep inflation probably closer to 2.5 or 3%.
So what does that mean for stocks? Do we need to see a rate cut, you know, a move towards the 2% for stocks to end the year, you know, much higher than they are right now? I mean, we're already up 7% year to date. It seems like so far the stock market has been fairly resilient despite all of these changing macro factors.
Yeah, it's a really great observation in terms of the resilience of the market. And in fact, we moved last week to add more money to equities. We were slightly overweight, now we're more overweight. We added to both US large cap and developed large cap. And the reason we did so was because we think the outlook has much more upside than downside right now. We're not seeing many scenarios that would result in a hard landing or a recession. We're seeing a moderating consumer. And the question around the monetary direction of the Fed, or the speed at which they move to a loosening posture, we think has more of an impact on where to invest within equities than whether or not to move to an overweight. So if, in fact, it takes longer because the economy is stronger, we think that's going to continue to favor large cap tech stocks, somewhat ironically, given that they're supposedly inversely correlated to interest rates, but that's not what's happening recently. If, on the other hand, the Fed does move in July and moves maybe 3 or 4 times this year, then we're going to start to see, I think, a further broadening out into small caps and into some of the more cyclically sensitive areas of the stock market.
That's Tony Roth, Chief Investment Officer over at Wilmington Trust, joining us from Pennsylvania.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.